Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're listening to Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Jaca. Today, we are talking about senior citizens and different aspects of their lives, from the politically active to those seeking an education. You'll get all of that on this week's episode of Real College Podcast, which starts right now. In your lifetime, there's a good chance that you'll meet someone who will leave an impact on the world. Nathan Fervoy talked to someone who met the one and only Bob Dylan.
In the monotonous back and forth of college life, the area centered in Dinkytown can start to feel very small and disconnected from the rest of the world around it. It can be hard to remember that legends have walked these very streets. Listening to Irving Kurita's stories, we're transported to a dinky town of old, where in place of a Subway sandwich shop, a coffee house once stood, and the beginnings of a star were cultivated.
So anyway, I went to Minneapolis. I bought a little Volkswagen and drove to Minneapolis. I had been singing and playing guitar and folk music. Mm-hmm. So I was looking for an area around Minneapolis where I could find places for folk music. So I discovered Dinkytown.
Yeah.
And there was a coffee house called the 10 O'Clock Scholar. Hmm. And
do you remember like what street that was on? Or
it was around like 14th Street. And it was a mecca for a lot of young kids and who were interested in folk music. And like it was like the bohemian section of around the university. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, I discovered this store and I walked in, and it was in kind of a narrow store with some tables. And as I walked in, there was a platform and there was a kid up there singing and playing the guitar. And I stood there and I, you know, watched him for a little while. Had a nice voice, you know, just like I had. And but he was crude with the guitar. You know, it was three chords or something like that. And after he finished, he walked over to the edge of the platform, and I said to him, "How long have you been playing and singing folk music?" Well, he said, I just started doing that. I'm a freshman at the University of Minnesota, and but I'm interested in folk music. So anyway, I said, you know, I was one of the first students at the Old Town School of Folk Music in Chicago. And he said, really? Oh boy, we got to get together. You know, that's the first thing he said to me. I went back to the back part of the coffee shop. The owner was there at the bar. And I said, how often does this kid play for? He says, well, he comes every other day. And I pay him $5 a night. And I said, and he said his name was Bob Dylan. He said, his name is not Bob Dylan. He just started calling himself that.
Yeah, yeah.
His name is Bobby Zimmerman, and he's from Hibbing, Minnesota. Anyway, that's what he told me. By the way, that's typical Dylan, you know. He was a scrawny kid, you know, he's pimply and curly hair. Well, anyway, I got to know him, and he liked me a lot. I had a car. He didn't have a car. And I would, he never went to class. And was hanging around sororities or the fraternities, things like that. And I'm here, I'm 11 years older than him. Yeah. I'm 29, and he's 18 at the time. I started coming back there, and then we got to be very good friends at that time, because that's all he was interested in, was absorbing mm-hmm. as much as he could about folk music. And he had a little following at the coffee shop. So I think it was maybe it was a Saturday night or something like that. Mm-hmm. And right in, and I'll meet you right in front of the 10 o'clock scholar, he said. And, well, I said, I'll drive by and pick you up, and then we'll go to John Kerner, had an apartment, and we'll go up there and sing and, you know, hang around. And so I came back that day, it was about 7 o'clock, and I drove right up to the store, and I got out, and he was standing in front of the door. And so I said, well, come on, wait a minute. Music was coming out of this place. Mm-hmm. I said, well, he said, nah, let's go. And I know, I said, I want to see what's going on. So I opened the door, mm-hmm. and the way it was before, this little platform, and he would be up there singing, there were chairs all the way this way, and mm-hmm. a guy up here was singing folk songs. Mm-hmm. And he was good.
Yeah.
You know, and so Dylan and I went around back of the chairs, we're standing and watching him. And he was really good with the guitar, he had a great voice and everything. And then Dylan kept on saying, come on, you know, he was a little star there.
You know.
So he said, come on, Irv, let's go. I said, wait, I want to hear this guy. And he was really good. He was mm-hmm. with the guitar, he had a very nice voice. Mm-hmm. And he kept on, he didn't want to, I don't think he even looked at this guy, you know. He just kept on saying, come on, let's go. We got to go to Kerner's. Yeah, I said. But the guy who was, I remember this, and I said, you know, he kind of looked familiar to me. Mm-hmm. At that time, I think he had a...
This musician, who Dylan refused to look at out of jealousy, turned out to be Peter Yarrow, a figure who would come back into Dylan's life in a big way some years later. As part of the group Peter, Paul, and Mary, Paul would record Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind in 1963. This version reached number one on the Billboard charts, putting Dylan on the map in a big way.
So anyway, we left. You know, he kept on singing. And I don't even know if he wanted to look at this guy. He's just, that's all he was saying. Come on, Irv, let's go. So we went to the Kerner's, and one day he came over to I lived with another guy in the first floor of a house. Mm-hmm. You know where Franklin Boulevard is? And it's next to the river.
Yeah.
Now, at that time, I think 94 is going through this area, but it wasn't at that time. So one day I played a song for him called Hard Travelin' by Woody Guthrie. You know, I've been doing some hard traveling. I thought, you know. He says, what's that? Mm-hmm. And I said, that's a song by Woody Guthrie. It's called Hard Traveling. I don't think he knew much about Woody Guthrie at all. Mm-hmm. But that became a big part of his life. About a month later, he says, Irv, you know, I learned that song. And he played it for me. Now, all the time, he was soaking up so much on folk music. And one time, he said, Irv, I'm going to hitchhike to Denver, you know. So he comes back about 3 weeks later, and he says, oh, and I met John Lee Hooker, and he said, let me show you. He showed me a riff. I said, that's nice. Thing about him is, like, you couldn't believe him a lot of times, you know, and I just took all this as a, you know, who we met and played with, and so on. But he had a way of mimicking other singers' styles, but he had a very nice voice. You know? Mm-hmm. It wasn't a Woody Guthrie voice, and he never, except once, told me that he wrote a song.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember it being, it was that kind of a pretty melody. It's like his mother, and it was a nice song he wrote. But that's the only time in the whole year that we hung around together that I... Anyway, I had been there almost a year, and I wanted to get back to Chicago. And I told him I was leaving and going to Chicago and I'll be working for United Cerebral.
After a year of living in Dinkytown, Irv moved back to Chicago for a new job. But it wouldn't be the last time he heard from Dylan.
I'm sorry.
No, it's all right.
It's October and I started United Cerebral Palsy in August.
Mm-hmm.
So I get a call from a girl and she says, "Hey, Mr. Creator, remember me? My name, you know, I was..." So I said, "No, I don't quite remember you." She says, "Hey, I got a friend here who wants to talk to you." So I said, "Who is this?" She says, "His name is Bob Dylan." So I said, "Really? Okay." So I pick up the phone, and he says, "Irv, I'm hitchhiking my way to New York, and I wonder if we could get together."
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Sure, but I'm working now, but I could meet you around the time I would go to lunch."
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Fine," you know, he was excited about it. "And I'll meet you."
Mm-hmm. There.
So my boss, about 11 o'clock in the morning, said, "Irv, we're looking for a summer camp location in Aurora, and I want you to go out there." So I'm absolutely sure that he went there and he waited and waited and waited, and I was in Aurora. I didn't get back until 4 o'clock or something like that. And why he didn't call me, I don't know. He didn't. You know, I don't know. Maybe he decided then that I dissed him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I would have felt that way too. You know.
Yeah, yeah.
But I had no choice. I'm a new job. I didn't know where he was at. He didn't have cell phones. I couldn't call him back or anything like that. So that was the last time I saw him. And getting back to him,
mm-hmm.
he goes to New York, starts hanging around in Greenwich Village, and he starts writing topical songs. And he starts singing the way... coming from Oklahoma, and the way you've heard him all this time, he took on the whole persona of Woody Guthrie.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Dylan, you know. Uh-huh. I never heard him sing again like I heard him sing. He had a nice voice.
Yeah. So, yeah, because he's kind of known for a strange voice now a little bit.
He's always been that way. It was the whole Woody Guthrie thing. And then he started writing. His singing was horrible. I mean, all these years, you know, and people have criticized him. The guy just got a Nobel Prize for literature.
Yeah.
And then, you know, doing the secretive thing and being a different kind of guy.
So, Bob, if you're listening, your old friend Irv didn't mean to diss you that day. So, maybe acknowledge the influence his Woody Guthrie album had on you. Come on, embrace those Dinkytown roots.
The traditional path that we're taught in life is that you graduate high school and then you go to college. For some people, that's not the case, and so school comes later in life, or you go back later. Elizabeth Yost talked to older students at the U about what brought them back.
We all have to deal with old white men. We joke about it all the time in politics, engineering, medicine. But Richard is an old white man that I know from something completely different. He's in my undergraduate sociology of migration class. Even though Richard is a full 50 years older than I am, we sit right next to each other in class. We take notes, he scribbles furiously with a Bic pen on an old legal pad, and I type away on my laptop. I assumed that this age difference was a defining aspect of Richard's experience. How could it not be weird to be 70 in a room full of 20-somethings? But Richard doesn't think it matters very much.
I don't think I'm treated differently. At least I'm not aware of it. Of course, I've been blissfully unaware of a lot of things, probably throughout my life. But the things that sociology does, I've always been connected in a way emotionally to sociology, social psychology, for instance, and the things that are studied. So I'm enjoying it. I enjoy this class we're in together, studying, looking at migration and movements around the world. And I don't feel necessarily that I have a role. If anything, I could give maybe a longer view of things. I think we're in society, we're notoriously short-sighted, and we have to look at that really history didn't just begin when we were born. History has been going on for eons, and we're just part of it. We just play a part while we're alive.
I knew Richard was a smart guy. He says really intelligent things in class. He has a really interesting research project going on right now. But I had no idea how fascinating his life was and how much work he had to do to get to this point.
Most of my, out of high school, I went to Mankato State University now. Wasn't really too interested in being a student, and went into the Army, and then...
Richard didn't just join the Army. This was during the war in Vietnam, but he got sent to Germany, where he says he just drank a lot of beer and waited till he could go home.
When I came back out of the Army, I went back there, but used up all the GI Bill and moved to the cities, and... Took a couple classes at the U back then in the 1970s, and still wasn't. I was still more interested in partying than studying. So here I am now, after spending time in prison and spending time, as an alcoholic, education is or learning is a part of something that interests me, so I enjoy it.
And as it turns out, finding your love for education once you're a senior citizen works out pretty great.
You, as a land-grant university, they're required to help the population of Minnesota, the citizens of Minnesota, to study. And so after 62, or at 62 years old, you get $10 a credit tuition. So my books cost a lot more than my classes do.
But Richard's sociological education didn't begin with this cheap tuition. This is a person who was a teenager in the 60s.
I realized the prejudice in my own father was, prejudiced, so I knew that something was not right. And then when TV had showed the civil rights issues in the South, especially in the 60s, I got more and more aware of that people were being treated poorly, and that's always been an emotional issue for me, I guess. And then when I went away to college in the Army, and as life went on, I got to know a lot of people who were affected in that way.
Most of these people were baby boomers, a vaguely defined generation that I don't completely understand, but Richard had a lot to say about them.
The beginning of that group that were born in 46, 47, 48, were coming of age in the 60s. So I think it was a natural awakening. Young people tend to be concerned about a lot of things. So I think it's a natural thing that happened in the 60s and the things that have gone on since then, the awakening, so to speak, empowerment of groups that have been historically disempowered. If, as Bob Dylan said and wrote in 55, 60 years ago, you better start swimming or sink like a stone because the times are changing. And if we want to stay in back in those old times mentally, we're gonna drown. We're gonna sink.
This conversation with Richard made me really hopeful. If someone who's seen the Cold War, alcoholism, and the inside of a jail cell can still go to class, maybe we'll all be okay. For Real College Podcast, I'm Elizabeth Yost. You have grown and accepted that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are changing.
Aging is a part of life, and so also it's a part of the government. In Minneapolis, the Advisory Committee on Aging helps the City Council to advocate for aging residents and to ensure that their needs are considered in legislation. To find out more about this committee and what it does, Real College Podcast producer Ben Hallam spoke to Christina Kendrick, Senior Community Engagement Specialist at the City of Minneapolis. She's the lead staff for the Advisory Committee on Aging.
So the Advisory Committee on Aging is a City of Minneapolis advisory board and commission. It is a council-established advisory committee. All of our boards and commissions in the City of Minneapolis, the role is to advise. It's a mechanism to bring people's voices so they can assist in influencing decisions that are made that are going to impact community. Specific to the Advisory Committee on Aging, they've been around for the dawning of time. And we recently, we'll call it reconfigured the committee. It used to be, I think it was 25 deep. Now it is down to 17, 13 are ward-based for our mayor appointee. We've lowered the age to 50 for the member at large, which is the mayoral appointee. It is not age-specific. Those applications are, I would say, a lot more vetted if they're under 50 years old, specific to their role in community, maybe their career, or even a U of M student who has interest in aging issues.
So what are some of the current priorities for the Advisory Committee on Aging?
So the Advisory Committee on Aging right now, I would say their number one focus is our action plan. In 2015, we passed what's called the Minneapolis for a Lifetime Strategic Framework, and we were approached by AARP in partnership with the World Health Organization to be designated an age-friendly community. Age-friendly communities is the World Health Organization's community aging model. And we actually use one of their model as well as other models to construct the Minneapolis for a Lifetime strategic framework. So we were the first city in the state of Minnesota to be designated an age-friendly community by AARP and the World Health Organization. And with that, we had to develop an action plan.
How did you involve Minneapolis's aging community in creating your strategic framework?
We had our aging community involved for sure. So we did have some representatives from, it was actually called the Senior Citizen Advisory Committee at that time. So we did have some representatives from that particular advisory committee on our steering committee. And as we developed the themes, arenas, goals for the strategic framework, we would go to the community, and we had 8 or 9 community listening sessions of older adults. And we even took these community listening sessions outside of Minneapolis to the surrounding suburbs. So we went to Bloomington, we went to Richfield, St. Louis Park, and spoke with older adults there. laying a opening question, and that was your friend or family member comes up to you and says, hey, I'm thinking about moving to Minneapolis. What would your response be? We also got the pulse of, did anyone live in Minneapolis? Did they move for a reason? If they haven't lived in Minneapolis, why not? They were given the goals, you know, we asked them if we're on the right track. The influence that community had is that we went out to the community with 3 goals and ended up with 5 for the Minneapolis for a Lifetime strategic framework.
What is the basic outline of the plan you've developed and are working on right now?
It's a pretty robust plan, but the 3 big themes are housing, transportation, and health and wellness. And in those priorities, there's 3 or 4 different priorities with 3 or 4 different potential action steps that even list off future partners. Right out the bat, thinking about transportation, pedestrian activities are involved in that. You know, having conversations with Public Works on exploration of snow removal models in other cities, that's always kind of a thing that comes front and center. Nobody seems to have figured it out, but some people have some pretty decent pilots.
What are some of the recent accomplishments of the advisory committee?
We actually have had some accomplishments from the Minneapolis for a Lifetime strategy. When AARP approached us about the designation, the city and our advisory committee on aging and the members of the original steering committee, we felt very strong about the work that we'd done and accomplished immediately after our strategic framework was received and adopted. Our housing division, for the first time, I think it was like 15 years, went to council and amended the senior housing initiative that actually added a significant amount of funding and supports to that housing plan. So right off the bat, we had an immediate win.
What are some of the challenges the advisory committee has faced while implementing the action plan?
So the action plan was just adopted in 2017. So maybe I should start there, is that it's still fairly new. In that, we, of course, had an election and a turnover. So we're now in the process of getting the new council members up to speed, which hasn't been difficult at all. They're very in tune with what you would assume the needs of an aging population are, which for me is thrilling. Minneapolis is a very youth-centric city, and the city that's responsible for keeping Hennepin County's median age in the low 30s. So the challenges have been to really look at this as a priority. The philosophy behind the action plan and the intent of the action steps that are suggested really is that 8 to 80, or supports for the most vulnerable, so the youngest of the youngest and the oldest of the oldest. So the theme throughout the action plan has a lot of intergenerationalism, as well as the value that older adults bring to a community, so kind of changing the language that's out there, the Western philosophy of how we look at aging compared to globally, how other communities look and respect the value that older adults bring to their communities.
And finally, what is the advisory committee working on for the future?
I would say the main thing right now is looking at the last year that the action plan has been in place, and seeing what our accomplishments are, developing the work plan for 2018 and how we move forward. The action plan is set for 3 years, so going through 2020. So thinking ahead and looking at, do we need to adjust? It's a very fluid plan. It's not meant to be sitting on a shelf. It's a working document. So that's what we're tackling right now.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Ben Hallam.
We've wanted to do something on housing and homelessness in the Twin Cities for some time. Because there's such a diverse range of people and information in local homelessness, it was hard to pin a place to start. A couple months ago, reporter Emily Allen met with Danielle Werder from the Hennepin County Office to End Homelessness. She got a lot of helpful information on the different sides to homelessness, but one statistic that stood out pertained to senior citizens. Of all the sheltered people Werder knew, 15% were between 51 and 61, and 7% were 62 and up.
I just noticed this game board over here. Was it a gym before?
Yeah, it was a gym, a church gym and community gym.
That's John Vidica, yeah, a volunteer coordinator and advocate from Simpson Housing Services in Minneapolis. John is a staff member at the single adult shelter under the Simpson Church. It's been around since the 1980s, when it was first a men's shelter built over the church basketball court. Most recently, they've added a women's side to the basement, too. There's a supply closet, bathrooms, suppers, and breakfasts provided by local organizations who sign up months in advance, and specialists like nurses come in twice a week for checkups. John is one of the local homelessness advocates focusing on resources for senior citizens who are experiencing homelessness. Reporter Emily Allen met John at the Simpson Shelter last week to talk about seniors experiencing homelessness and what a movement to help them looks like right now.
The bottom line is we don't have affordable housing enough in the Twin Cities, in the metro area.
That's John Vodica, a volunteer coordinator and advocate for Simpson Housing in Minneapolis.
You know, the vacancy rate for any of us looking for an apartment in Minneapolis is less than 3%. The going rate now for a one-bedroom is over $1,000 a month, and folks on a fixed income or a low income or no income just are not going to be able to, even if, you know, they're just not going to be able to find the housing.
John has been with Simpson since he moved here about 9 years ago from Georgia. He's always worked on social justice in some form or another.
A number of years ago, my wife and my three children, when they were very young, and I lived in what's called a Catholic worker community in Atlanta, Georgia, that where we had 40 people in under the same roof, 15 or 20 of us who had not experienced homelessness, and another 15 or 20 of us who were formerly homeless. So we provided a lunch meal for folks on the street. We provided shelter for folks who were experiencing homelessness. We had nurses and foot care and clothes closet and all that sort of thing in under one roof in downtown Atlanta. And that was really my up-close introduction to homelessness. This would have been in the early, mid-80s. So
lately, in the last 8 years, John says, he's noticed more senior citizens coming into the shelter.
On any given night, over the last several years anyway, we probably have, of the 66 people that are staying with us, 15 to 20 of them are 60 years and older. We've got several 70-year-olds staying with us right now, and we have we've had an 84-year-old stay with us in the past.
There's no big reason more seniors are experiencing homelessness, other than the fact that there's just so many baby boomers.
So one is the baby boomers, people my age, are getting older. I think folks suddenly find themselves out of work, on a fixed income now, if any income. Their bodies break down a little bit. A medical bill, you know, sends them, you know, reeling, and they wind up, you know, or a spouse dies or whatever, and they end up on the street or unable to maintain the house or the apartment that they were in at one time.
Shelters like Simpson are a resource for seniors experiencing homelessness, as they are for anyone experiencing homelessness. Unfortunately, John says, Simpson is just an overnight shelter. They're only open from 5 p.m. to 9 a.m. after some old zoning requirements and a lack of resources to go 24/7.
I visited one of our former guests a couple years ago who had heart issues, fluid on his lungs, he was obese, and he had a minor heart attack away from the shelter, and I visited him at the emergency, in the intensive care unit, a couple days after he had the heart attack, and the nurse came in while we were visiting and said, "We're going to discharge you this afternoon." And I said, "I don't think so." And I got back here to the shelter, and who was standing out there at the door at 5 o'clock but this guy who just came out of the intensive care unit. He'd been in his own little room at the hospital for less than a day. And he had a bag of medicine, and this is where he was told to go.
John knows some guests from the night shelter will go to day shelters in the time they can't be there, or sometimes they'll go to the library. The downtown Minneapolis library even has an outreach worker, John says, that can work with any library goers experiencing homelessness.
To let them know this is how the bus runs, this is where you can go to get a meal, here's the number you can call to try to get into shelter, and that sort of thing.
But for seniors specifically, there's really nothing.
Up until last year, there was a place in the Skyways that was welcoming to any senior citizen. And a lot of our senior guests would utilize that. They could go and have coffee, comfortable surroundings, reading, television, community together. It's gone. They closed it down.
A couple years ago, John hosted a workshop at a conference in Rochester for people working against homelessness.
2 years ago, I did a workshop at the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless annual conference down in Rochester that year on seniors. We were expecting 25 or 30 people to attend, and we had about 100 people show up at the workshop.
Their coalition is the only thing John knows of that's actively working for some change. But even that is pretty loose.
Following the conference, we met 3 or 4 times pretty regularly, and basically the Wilder Foundation decided out of those meetings that it was going to do another special report on just senior homelessness, which came out middle of last year, I think. And so now we have a document that just kind of looks at all the various issues that seniors who are experiencing homelessness face and where there could be something in place but isn't. And so I think the plan now is to take that document and work it into some sort of legislative proposal.
For Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Emily Al.
That is all for this week's episode of Real College Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It's produced by Liv Riggins, Ben Hallam, and Alex Schumacher. I'm your host and managing editor, Jacob Maldonado Medina. Thank you so much for listening, and head over to radiok.org/realcollegepodcast to hear all of our previous episodes. And make sure you tune in every Monday at 6:30 for more arts and culture coverage.